This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. It's hard to believe, but there's 1 week left in 2020. And with stay-at-home orders in place on and off since March, many of us spent the year living through our screens. We don't have open mic nights, but we did have Sarah Cooper.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute.
We didn't have concerts, but we did have versus battles. We didn't have parties, but we did have Animal Crossing. And we didn't have movie theaters, but we did have streaming services, and they were more than willing to step up to the plate.
'Cause I saw Tiger.
Maybe you've noticed your weekly screen time report start to climb, or that your eyes are a little more tired by the end of the day. Being extremely online has changed our attitude towards pop culture, media, even politics. But what is all this screen time doing to our brains? Here to answer that question is E. Alex Jung, senior writer at Vulture. Alex, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We're also joined by David Greenfield, founder of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction. He's also an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Terry Nguyen, a reporter on internet and culture at Vox. Terry, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Alex, I want to start with our pop culture appetites. In a recent piece for Vulture, you coined the term quarantine brain. What is that?
I think it's the feeling that we all experienced where our brains were a little broken and fuzzy because we were all by ourselves but connected through the internet. And that feeling of mania just sort of spilled out everywhere into these really absurd kind of, I would say, Dadaist ways in terms of how we processed and experienced culture.
Well, you also write about a shift that's taking place where Hollywood executives are losing touch with what consumers want. Explain that.
Well, I guess it's less about, I think, what I was trying to say in some ways was that the structure within which Hollywood tries to produce content, which is mostly through TV and film, is inherently too big and too slow to really respond to or take the moment in. And because everything was changing so quickly, day to day, hour to hour, in terms of the news and how we were feeling, that it sort of felt like by the time someone was trying to make a TV show or a film about the pandemic, it usually fell flat, I think, because they were usually just trying to reproduce the same thing that they had done before the pandemic. But I think what they failed to really understand was that the quarantine had changed how we were feeling and experiencing content or entertainment, for lack of a better word. And I think that's sort of the shift that you saw, or this dissonance between what Hollywood was producing and then what we were actually consuming and entertained by.
Terry, when you think about media over the past year, are there a couple of examples that come to mind for you? You know, things that in a normal year wouldn't be popular, but in 2020 are.
Yeah, what's interesting to me, I think early on in the pandemic, there were folks who really wanted to watch pandemic shows, but then there were also people, and I fall into that camp, who started rewatching a lot of kind of classic TV shows. And I think there were a lot of explainers or guides published about what you should watch. I remember seeing a lot of those about The Sopranos or Mad Men or even Twin Peaks, these sort of drawn out, very long shows you can binge watch over an indefinite period of time. And that's kind of what I felt more people gravitated towards for a feeling of comfort, I think.
David, you know, being online right now on social media, there seems to be this infinite scroll of new information all the time. How do you think it impacts our behavior or the way we see the world?
Well, I think that it absolutely affects the way we see the world, because we see the world as always on and always encroaching on our attention and consciousness. We're not really wired to be attentive and available for consumption of information 24/7. We're actually designed to have intermittent spurts of attention that are necessary for our survival. But when you absorb this much content with no break, there's an overload, and we call that tech stress syndrome. And we knew about this before the pandemic, but obviously the amount of consumption that we've had during the pandemic has really created a whole new game.
Well, this new year's news cycle was also particularly intense. There were a lot of high stakes questions open, and along with this endless scroll of information, how does consuming lots of stressful news affect us?
Well, not good, because there is this sort of perception that if you miss something, similar to the FOMO phenomena, that you're going to somehow be left behind or you're going to miss some critical piece of information. But the reality is that most news feeds repeat information over and over and over again. And one of the things you have to remember, with the exception perhaps of public broadcasting, news channels are all, in a sense, making money from keeping your eyeballs on that screen, and they want your attention. I mean, you are the object of that story, and they want you to keep watching it. And the fact that you're watching it over and over again because you think you're going to miss something critical is really erroneous. You're not going to miss anything critical. In fact, prior to the pandemic, I hardly watched news, and I did just fine. In fact, I think that we watch way too much news. We don't need to consume that. It also colors your world. You think the way you see the world through the news media.
You know, Alex, another thing I think a lot of folks were consuming this year is comedy. It's been a big year for memes and internet comedians. And I know it's difficult to put into words, but how do you think internet humor is different than the type of comedy we see on TV or even in traditional stand-up?
I think it feels more absurdist, which I think has always been true of internet humor to some kind of basic degree. I think there's always been a sort of surrealist, oddball aspect to it, whether you're thinking of Drill's Twitter account or like Horse eBooks or like things back in the day that feel like ancient now to me. But I think that it feels to me punchier. There's more trolling. There's more kind of just like a zany, madcapped, harebrained aspect to comedy that feels, I don't know. It's interesting to me. It feels subversive, but also a little uncontrollable. And like there's this sort of horizontal collectivist aspect to it. So when a meme happens, it's really like a bunch of people constantly making a joke or improving on the joke or doing their own spin on the joke in a way that you know, you don't have to necessarily be a comedian or be making comedy for a living, but you can sort of participate in it. And that's kind of the at least a small joy of a meme, I think.
Well, you've cited comedian Sarah Cooper as an example of someone who sort of capitalized on this in 2020. And we played a clip of her in the intro, but it's hard to play a clip of Sarah Cooper because the bit she's primarily known for is mouthing along to President Trump. Is there a way for something like that to translate to a more traditional platform?
That's a good question. I don't know. I haven't really seen it yet. In that sense, I think that the bite-sized absurdist aspect of it is watching it on your phone and watching it happen right after a news conference or a press conference, because Trump himself is so absurd that there's no real sort of topping him in some ways. And so like, the absurdity is just like her repeating whatever he's saying or lip syncing to that. I don't know her. I don't particularly think her special sort of translated that energy into a sketch comedy in a way that felt successful. But I sort of assume that it will demand a sort of reimagining of a form that maybe isn't a traditional TV sitcom or a film or a studio film the way we normally think about it. I think translating that kind of absurdist energy is really a formal question rather than a content one, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. David, you mentioned, you know, our doom scrolling as being a form of FOMO or fear of missing out. But how much was that heightened by the fact that we were missing out on, you know, so much human connection, our regular activities, you know, the things that we sort of built our day around? David, are you still with us?
Oh, yeah. No, you cut out for a second. I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
Oh, well, actually, I'll bring that question to you after the break, because we're going to have to go to a break in just a second. We're talking about our internet habits during the pandemic with Alex Jung, senior writer at Vulture. Also with us, Terry Nguyen from Vox and psychiatry professor David Greenfield. If you want to share your experience in 2020, how did your media use change? Did you find yourself spending a lot more time with your screens, or maybe you kind of turned everything off? We want to hear from you. Drop a message on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're discussing how being extremely online during the pandemic has changed our behavior and maybe even our brains. We're joined by Alex Jung. He's a senior writer at Vulture. Also with us, Terry Nguyen, who covers the internet and pop culture at Vox, and David Greenfield, the founder of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction. He's also an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine. We also want to hear from you. How has the internet changed your habits this year? What platforms helped fill the void of being able to go places and see people? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. David, before the break, I was asking about this fear of missing out and how that may lead us to spending more time online than we should. But how much of that was exacerbated by the fact that we really were missing out on you know, family events, our regular schedules, the things that we shape our lives around?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is, of course, we're all missing out. And the things that make life rich are relationships and interactions with people. My preference, of course, would be that as much of that should be real time. And we didn't have any of that. So there's this, you know, there has been a mass retreat to screens. I mean, really, the screen has been really the only connection we've had to both social, business, and entertainment. So there is a natural tendency during a pandemic like this to retreat to the screen. The problem is that it doesn't provide that nutrient that we need in terms of social interaction. So I think people feel very flat, and they feel that they're craving interactions with people in a way that they haven't had. Simple things like going to a store, you know, and being out and about with people are eluding people right now. And of course, during the holidays, it increases significantly because people feel a pull to be around those they love during the holiday. And you can't do that, not in the way that we used to.
Well, a lot of us searched for entertainment this year, and some award shows did happen. But the biggest music moments seem to exist on social media with Instagram versus battles. And these are live streams where two artists play their hits back to back and square off on whose discography is better. 1A explored the appeal of versus battles earlier this year. Here's music and culture writer Naima Cochran.
This isn't to promote a project. This isn't to, you know, get exposure for your new joint. This is totally about nostalgia and a reminder of why these people are in the upper echelon of artists and entertainment and cultural influence in a time when A, we don't have sports, and B, we can't go out to live events during live event season. This kind of feeds us a little bit of what we need from both of those elements.
Terry, why do you think Versus worked so well?
Yeah, I think that online, as David mentioned earlier, people had lost contact with others socially. And I think this is one of the manifestations of kind of activities that people gravitated towards. A similar thing happened, you know, on TikTok, and people sort of started picking up sort of these micro trends. And these trends kind of migrated, I think, across various platforms, like from TikTok to Instagram to Twitter, where people were discussing about how they were baking bread, or they were, you know, making a new coffee recipe, or they were, you know, hosting virtual PowerPoint parties with their friends. I do feel like the online concert series happening on Instagram was just sort of a reflection of people wanting to congregate in a space and them having to carve out that virtual space for themselves.
David, what does our attraction to these types of events tell us about our need for social interaction and how that impacts our brain?
Yeah, we have a social brain. If you really take away social interaction, or if you have someone that has very little social interaction, you're going to see an unhealthy human being psychologically. So we are social animals, and we need to interact with people. And I agree. I think that the interactions that we joined online were attempts to grab some of that interaction, albeit one step removed in a two-dimensional format. So in order to be healthy physically and psychologically, you've got to connect with other people in some way. And if you can't connect literally, you'll connect virtually. It is the next best thing. But it's not nutritive. It just doesn't provide the depth and quality and tenant that we feel when we're near somebody else. And those interactions don't have to be deep. They just have to be real.
Well, one major factor in people's love of Versus is that you can interact with the performers and with other celebrities who are watching along. How much does that play into it?
I think interaction is what it's all about. It's feeling that your words are being heard and that you matter, that what you say will be listened to and be responded to. That's all we want. That's really the nature of social interaction. And that's what provides the quality that we need.
Well, a lot of people love celebrities when it's, you know, Michelle Obama chiming in on a Versus battle. But this year, it was also full of moments like this.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
No hell below us.
Above us only sky.
So that was Imagine John Lennon's Imagine, performed by a myriad of celebrities, including Wonder Woman actress Gal Gadot. This was a highly memeified moment on the part of those celebrities. It seemed sincere. But Alex, why do you think this resonated so poorly with so many people?
Oh, I would say it resonated very well.
Really?
Oh, no, it didn't land
okay.
at all, right,
okay.
In terms of their intention. They did do it sincerely, and I think that's why it was so funny. And ultimately a win for the internet, you know. I think quarantine has been a moment, especially early on, when celebrities didn't have managers and publicists telling them what to do or protecting them from themselves in some ways. And I think that what you saw was just how unreal and out of touch extremely rich and famous people are. And so they didn't have the prophylactic of this whole mediation system that they're usually used to. And they just put things on the internet thinking, oh, I'm one of you. I understand what you're going through. And then everybody saw that and I think roundly made fun of them, which was the fun part, I think.
Well, Terry, you had moments like that Imagine cover, but then you also had celebrities like Leslie Jordan and Florence Pugh using their platforms to connect to people, relate to them. Why do you think they were better received?
Yeah, I do think a part of it is authenticity, but another part of it is just being down to earth. And it seems like there are different swaths of celebrities, and, you know, because they're different people, what they see as appropriate in this current moment shifts as well. I think one celebrity example that really sticks in my mind is something that's really silly and kind of ridiculous that no normal person would ever say was when Madonna was bathing in rose petals, and I think she said something that, like, the coronavirus is the great equalizer. And, you know, as a celebrity with a large platform, like, some of that is going to rub people the wrong way. And I feel like someone like Florence Pugh, who was just kind of cooking her own kitchen, and admittedly, I have watched her content as well, is because she just seemed so normal and didn't kind of exacerbate that she was suffering in any way. But again, it just varies by personality. And I think a lot of celebrities, especially someone like Madonna, who might have been in the spotlight for a long time or doesn't really know how to respond to something like that, they probably just posting things to make themselves feel better, but it's just landing wrong on most people.
When we think about celebrity online and how celebrities are present, David, there's also this aspect of the conversation that has to do with comparison. There can be a tendency to compare your life or looks to those of a celebrity, specifically when you're a young person on social media. Is this something you hear about from your patients?
Yeah, because the reality is what we see on social media and in the media in general is the image that we kind of measure ourselves against. And, you know, being young and attractive, and then if you add in talented and rich, you know, these are the things that we're being weighed against. And I think some of the reaction people had to the videos that we were just talking about is, you know, you would see somebody talking, a celebrity talking about their life or the pandemic or their isolation, but you can see in the background this palatial house, and you know, you're looking around at your 1500 square foot house and they're in a mansion, and it's very hard to sort of feel comfortable or feel aligned with somebody when there is that big of discrepancy in your circumstances.
We're talking to psychiatry professor David Greenfield, Terry Nguyen from Vox, and Alex Jung, senior writer at Vulture. We're also hearing from you. Susan emailed, "Internet humor was therapy for me in 2020. Discovering the videos of comedian Randy Rainbow helped me keep my sanity during this crazy year." And Natasha emailed, "As a health and life coach, I have noticed a transformation in my own feelings towards technology. It is exhausting. When I go on walks or runs or short errands, I leave my phone at home. At home, my cell phone stays plugged in my bedroom so I can be as productive as possible. I can't tell you the last time I heard a notification on my cell. It remains on silent always." Same here, Natasha. Well, Terry, we saw record-breaking nationwide protests this summer against racism and police brutality. And while a lot of that activism was happening in the streets, a lot of it was also taking place online. And you've written about the phenomenon of activism through Instagram stories. Talk more about how people use the internet for social justice this year.
Yeah, one of the first posts I think I saw that in that phenomenon that I described as sort of Instagram activism was people were sending the message that you could still be involved while you were at home, even if you didn't feel safe to go out to protest or anything like that. And I do think it just kind of coalesced into this huge phenomenon of people sharing a lot of posts that independent artists and activists and advocacy groups have made, especially following or during the George Floyd protests. Some of this organizing, I think, also occurred at a local level as well. There was a lot of people in major cities working in mutual aid networks, grocery shopping, and figuring out how to do errands for their neighbors who might be elderly or immunocompromised. So I think a lot of that came as a result of the pandemic and people wanting to feel connected, as we originally mentioned. And this type of art form and activism form came out of that. I don't feel like this is new in the sense that people have always been sharing text on slides on Instagram, but it just took it to another level during quarantine, with pretty much like almost every other person on my own Instagram feed sharing either on their stories or just posting it on their feed.
David, do you think that sort of online activism helps people feel empowered in a specific way?
I think it helps them feel connected. I mean, that's really what we all want, to feel part of something. And whether it be to in the form of activism or helping somebody, we want to feel like we're connected to something outside of ourselves. And part of the, I think, insanity of the pandemic and the quarantine is this separation that it's created between us and everybody else. And we've taken for granted the small things and the small degree of connection that we have in daily activities that we don't have. So I think these are all ways to feel connected and feel part of something outside of ourselves. And if doing something good for somebody is a wonderful way to do that, but any way of connecting is useful. So I think that there's lots of opportunities for the internet to provide that, but it does fall short in some cases.
Well, you mentioned separation, and we should say that there were a ton of Americans primarily interacting online only with people on their side of the aisle. So just zoom out for us. Psychologically speaking, why do we tend to gravitate primarily to what we identify as our own group?
Because that's what we're comfortable with. There's a tendency to filter out things that are outside of our zone of identification or comfort. That's human nature. In order to be connected, in order to be open to something outside of your comfort zone, you have to open yourself in a way that might make you feel ill at ease. So there's a natural tendency to gravitate towards what you know and what you feel familiar with. Familiar is the way that people feel safe. And when you hear things that are uncomfortable or different, there's a degree of discomfort. Although I think that one way to create connection is to force yourself to be exposed to things that you're not comfortable with. So if you watch one news channel, you should watch another one to hear the opposite views, because I think that's how things change, is being exposed to something outside your zone of comfort.
Well, Alex, right now Americans don't even agree on who the next president will be. What role do you think the internet played in getting us to this moment politically?
I don't really know how to answer that. I mean, I don't really know how to answer that. I feel like the tenor of our reality feels manic, for lack of a better word, and I think that's largely in part due to the current sitting president that we have, and I think the sort of failure for the U.S. to respond to the pandemic versus other countries, you know, the fraying of a social safety net system, all of these things has contributed to people feeling unmoored, I think, to the very least, and I think that feeling of not being safe or not being on stable ground is kind of what has contributed to the absurdity of internet humor, which I think is actually why it does feel very political to me, because I think it is a response to the lack of a political and social infrastructure.
Terry, so, just about 30 seconds here. I mean, what role do you think the internet has played to this, just being in this place where, you know, we are really retreating into our own media bubbles?
Yeah, I also think part of that is platform produced. It's algorithmic, and it just kind of exacerbates that effect, especially when you're seeking comfort. And during a very political season, you want to be reading news that affirms your beliefs, which is why I think that kind of made it worse this year.
We're discussing how the pandemic has changed our social media habits with Alex Jung, senior writer at Vulture, Terry Nguyen from Vox, and psychiatry professor David Greenfield. We're also hearing from you and emailed. I'm a college professor, and I taught online during summer and fall semesters. What many people forget is that being online so much has a debilitating effect on our physical health as well. I have very dry eyes, and being on the computer so much hurts my eyes. It causes headaches, forces me to sit when I want to be moving, and causes my muscles to become sore. I am sick to death of being tied to this Mac. We'll hear more from you and from our guests in a moment. Now let's get back to our conversation about internet habits during the pandemic. We're talking to Alex Jung, senior writer at Vulture, Terry Nguyen from Fox, and psychiatry professor David Greenfield. Now, David, in the past few years, tons of Americans have begun to view anything they disagree with as misinformation or fake news. And obviously, the president's tweets about fake news don't help this phenomenon. But how can we check ourselves when our gut reaction to a news alert is, I don't like that, so it can't be true?
Yeah, that's a really big problem right now, is that we've created a new reality, which is the reality of if something is not to your liking, it just doesn't exist or it's fake. And I have great concern about that because, you know, as a scientist, my interest is in, fact, and that there are certain things that are true and that are factual and that they can't be reinvented or reconfigured or presented in a way that make them true when they're not or make them untrue when they are. So I think that this is part of the problem of the power of the internet and the power of social media, is that if you say something is true or not, enough people will believe it to be the case and they will align with it simply because it's consistent with their views or how they want the world to be. But that's not truth. That's just a perspective. And the danger is when you have somebody in a leadership position putting that out on a repeated basis, that's what we have currently seen in our situation. And I do have great concern about that, about this idea that you can bend reality and just declare whether something is real or not simply by an opinion and by the fact that you have enough people monitoring your channels.
Terry, how does social media make it easier to unwittingly share misinformation and disinformation? What have you observed over the past year?
Yeah, I think these platforms kind of allow people just algorithmically to kind of put themselves in certain echo chambers. I think this is not anything new that we've discussed. But what's concerning in the lead up to the election, I feel like, is the kind of scale of misinformation has gotten so wide that it's not just one platform that's doing this. If you're getting this false or biased information on YouTube and you're seeing a post from, say, a friend or a colleague on Facebook that confirms that, that kind of leads you to believe that maybe the results of the election weren't true, or maybe the coronavirus is not as bad as we thought. And it's not just people reading one post. I do feel like there has been this ecosystem of information, both that is made by politicians, by certain politicians, by certain media outlets, and by individuals, that kind of coalesce into this alternate reality that people are consuming. So I feel like it's really complicated and hard to even explain. And as a reporter, it's been challenging to track down where certain conspiracy theories might have originated and how to even tackle against that as someone who seeks to, who tries to report like non-biased, very factual information.
You know, David, when we talk about social media and misinformation and disinformation, oftentimes we think first of young people, but older people are the fastest growing user base for some social media platforms. Do you see a lot of the same issues with, you know, screen time or social media pressure or the spread of mis and disinformation in people whose brains are already fully developed?
Yeah, you do see it, but certainly they don't present for treatment. I think you're quite right, by the way, that the fastest growing segment of the internet use population and smartphone use is in the older demographic. You would think that because you have a wealth of experience through your lifetime, you'd be able to filter out fantasy from fact. So I think there is a little bit better discernment in that population, but I think anybody is vulnerable to influence, and anybody is vulnerable if they hear repetition of the same information, or in this case, disinformation, they're going to be vulnerable to being bent in a belief pattern that's maybe perhaps untrue. And so I think everybody is susceptible. Obviously, the younger you are, the more susceptible you are. But everyone has their potential to be biased and to perceive reality in a way that's consistent with the way they want to see it.
Well, we heard from some of you who are trying to cut down on your screen time.
My name is Jeffrey, and I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio. The past few years, I've been slowly weaning myself off of social media, and as of this year, sometime in June, I haven't had any accounts on Facebook, Reddit, Twitter, or anything of the sort, and it's been really refreshing. When I want to talk to people, especially like my parents, my family, my friends, I give them a call. The conversations are deep and meaningful, and they're a lot more refreshing. I have more personal time for going out on hikes, doing personal hobbies, and it has really done a lot for my mental health.
Jeffrey, thanks for that message. We also got this email from Patty who says, I have found myself retreating more into online games, sometimes for several hours a day. With all this time on hand having to stay home, I feel I should be getting more done. However, I have trouble motivating myself to doing even routine tasks. So David, from Jeffrey there, we heard, you know, him weaning himself off of social media, but then Patty is having an issue being motivated, you know, to break away from the screen. While we're at home, realistically, how do we avoid screens if we're trying to cut back?
Well, to some extent, you can't avoid them. Obviously, if you're a student, you need to use them for school. And if you're working from home, you need to use them to do your job. So, but I think it's creating, I love what Jeffrey did. And by the way, that's consistent with the data that we see from a lot of research, that when people extricate themselves from social media and from excessive internet use, they actually report much higher feelings of well-being, and the depth of their social interactions, real-time social, even if it's through telephone, it has improved significantly. So I think part of it is setting limits and boundaries. You know, one of the things that helps people understand the potential of this is that if you spend a few hours a day on a screen doing non-essential activities, that equals years of your life down the road. So you have to ask yourself, do you really want those years of your life spent on consuming video games or other meaningless activities online? Because we don't have more time. That's the only thing that's not negotiable. And I think setting some limits and boundaries, turning off notifications, leaving the phone in other rooms, you know, finding out ways to create activities for yourself that are more real-time based and not easily consumed. I mean, people like screens because they're easy. It's very easy to be entertained in front of a screen. It requires a little bit more planning in order to get off that screen.
Well, something Jeffrey said stood out to me. He said he weaned himself off social media. And thinking about Patty's situation, is the best thing to do is to try to cut back gradually rather than I'm going to delete everything, I'm going to throw the gaming console out, but to just try to set some gradual boundaries for yourself.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to do it. I mean, don't cut off every channel. In other words, you know, cut down your use on one and then slowly do it to another, and then limit yourself over time to perhaps one channel or one media outlet, and then move from social media to another one. And over time, you can reduce your use. I mean, the truth is, we say that we need them. And obviously, if your job requires you to monitor social media, it's certainly understandable. But for the most part, you don't need social media. It's just and really, it's kind of an oxymoron. There's nothing really social about social media. I mean, we call it social, but it doesn't really connect us in any significant way. And a conversation you have with quote unquote a friend on Facebook is not analogous to a conversation you have over a cup of coffee or even a phone call for that matter.
We're talking with psychiatry professor David Greenfield, Alex Jung, senior writer at Vulture, and Terry Nguyen from Vox. Now, we did hear from some of you who said the internet has fundamentally changed your habits in a good way.
Hi, this is Barbara. I live in Philadelphia. You asked about how I'm consuming media. Since I can't go to the gym, I'm using the YouTube videos to replace my gym classes, combination of aerobics and weightlifting. And while I'm doing that on my tablet, I'm watching the public television shows that I've recorded. So it's a really beautiful combination, and that takes up, with breaks, about 2 hours a day. So it's really nice, and it's different for me to be doing that.
Barbara, thanks for that message. Alex, how do you think the pandemic may permanently shift some of our habits? You know, once stay-at-home orders are lifted, you know, people like Barbara have found this new way of using the internet to work out from home. You think we're going to see some permanent changes?
Yeah, I think that things have already been accelerating towards going to this kind of level of convenience, to being at home, towards a kind of like isolationist aspect of consumption, whether that was Uber or Seamless or however you like, whatever apps have made it kind of easy to order things to you directly. I assume that people will still continue to do things that feel easy for them or convenient in that sense, that has already been developed online. So, you know, gyms, you know, I go to a gym that started in person and was always in person, but has moved to the internet and done digital classes. I assume you'll also see places have digital components now for the sake of convenience and because they've already created that infrastructure to do so. You know, I think that hopefully after the pandemic, people are going to pick and choose in terms of what is easy for them. Well, I think that's probably what you'll see.
Well, let's hear one more voicemail.
Hi, I'm Laura calling from Richmond, Virginia. I personally would never listen to hip hop. Usually I'm listening to rock stations, but with apps like TikTok, I'm exposed to so many different genres of music, and I actually found out that I love Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion. And the fact that these apps are using this music to just celebrate women and our empowerment this year just makes me want to jump up and down with joy.
With internet platforms rapidly becoming our primary source of entertainment, Alex, what do you think the future of pop culture looks like?
That's a great question. You know, even with music album rollouts, I think that you saw that there wasn't this need to do this large scale multimedia type of pop star rollout. You just had, you know, pop stars like Ariana Grande, Taylor Swift, just release and drop albums whenever they wanted. And I think that that kind of impromptu feeling is probably going to be here to stay in that sense.
But that does raise the question, because I think we do have these sort of fandoms or groups that find a community of sorts through social media, whether it's around music or it's around gaming or what have you. And Alex, I'm curious how you're thinking about community and social media these days.
I think that, you know, one of the most interesting things to me during the pandemic around fandoms were thinking or talking about K-pop stans, you know, and a lot of people and outlets were very surprised when K-pop stans would do what they considered like political activism, like they flooded the Dallas PD snitch cam with fan cam videos of their favorite stars or their favorite idols. You had them oversubscribe to Trump's Tulsa rally so that they thought that more people would come than they actually did. And you know, there was a lot of sort of like surprised coverage around that. But I don't really think that. It makes sense if you've been to a BTS concert and you see the people there. They're young, they're mostly women, they're mostly women of color. And there's this, I don't know, I think there is a sense of that you can connect meaningfully in a way that, you know, isn't the same thing as in-person interaction, but I don't think is meaningless. You know, I think that you can share political sensibilities just as much as a love for a star in the same space. And I don't think that one necessarily obfuscates the other.
Well, we have just about a minute left here. And David, I just want to give you a moment to talk about ways to stay connected to the world and to others while limiting screen time, because I think a lot of us are struggling with the feeling of isolation and separation and boredom.
Yeah, I mean, I think simple things like using the phone, you know, calling people, talking to friends, taking, you know, physical activity, getting outside if you can. I love the piece, the interview, the what she said about doing exercise. I mean, keeping physically fit is a very important component. And remembering to turn off the screen sometime and just separate yourself from it and do another activity is very important. But I think, and then also certainly using, you know, we didn't talk very much about, you know, Zoom and the disease of the day, which is having the Zoomies from being on the Zoom too much. But the Zoom can be used or another platform to connect us in normal social situations that we would be together, but now doing it over the internet. That can be very useful as well.
That was David Greenfield. He's the founder of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction. He's also an assistant clinical professor of psychiatry at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine. You also heard from E. Alex Jung, senior writer at Vulture, and Terry Nguyen, a reporter on internet and culture at Vox. Today's producer was Arfi Getty. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Now, we'll be on tape for a few days, but we'll be back next week. In the meantime, happy holidays. This is 1A.